Welcome back, folks. As I said at the opening this morning, we have a very special guest. You know, a lot of the guests that I bring on the show, I bring to you economists and strategists and things like that. A lot of people come from the industry. A lot of people come from people that you request. But very rarely do I bring on someone that really is held in such great esteem by the members of our profession. This gentleman is... he's considered the top of the pyramid. In fact, he goes all the way back to where he actually started the economics department at Merrill Lynch years ago at the age of 29, and is considered one of the foremost strategists and forecasters in our industry, and that is Dr. Gary Schilling, president of A. Gary Schilling and Company, and we are honored to have Dr. Schilling on this morning. Good morning, Dr. Schilling. How are you, sir?
Hey, great. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I know last year about this time, you were really looking for a global recession, and you had really strong concerns about both the U.S. economy and Europe. How's that unfolding as far as what you thought would happen?
Unfolding on schedule, I'm afraid. It sure looks like the U.S. economy is in or very close to a recession. We had 3 monthly declines in a row in retail sales in this country. April, May, and June. That has, 3 months in a row, has only occurred 29 times since they started the data in 1947, and 27 of the 29, the economy has been in a recession or within 3 months of its start. So that, as well as the overall weak employment numbers and income numbers, consumer borrowing cutting back, all of these things, I think, are confirming a very strong likelihood that the U.S. is in a consumer-led recession, and that's quite different than the normal Federal Reserve initiation. Just briefly, Europe is clearly in a recession. They've got their nonstop financial crisis, which has spilled over the goods and services side. And, of course, China more and more looks like a hard landing there, going back to much slower growth, 5 or 6%, well below the 7 or 8% it takes just to keep that economy going.
Let's go to the unemployment, for instance, because, you know, we're in the political season, and like yourself, I'm sure you talk to a lot of investors, and I'm talking to investors constantly on the show and when they come into my office, and they're quite confused, and because on one hand, they'll see very poor numbers. They'll see the unemployment rate goes from 8.2 to 8.3, but then on the other hand, they hear, and this is generally from the party in power, that, hey, we're adding jobs. We've had 29 straight months of job addition in the private sector. Things are really getting better. Are they getting better?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the overall situation, for example, last month, last Friday, when the payroll employment numbers were announced, they were a lot better than everybody expected. But the point is that if you looked at what happened on the household survey, the one that produces the unemployment rate, you had 195,000 fewer people working than the previous month. 150,000 dropped out of the labor force. People give up. They can't find jobs. I mean, it's a very weak employment picture out there, and it's not producing the kind of incomes that are going to support the kind of spending people had engaged in last year.
Yeah, in fact, that's an interesting point that you made. Joe Kernan was making that same point last week. He asked the simple question, you know, will my children live in an environment as good as the one I've lived in? And he made the point, and I've got 2 sons, one 29 and one 25, and they're not making as much money in their 20s as I made in mine, and I wasn't exactly setting the world on fire. But it seems like just the average earnings right now is actually moving down instead of moving up. Is this a permanent change, or is it a temporary
one?
It's
going to be with us as long as this deleveraging takes place. And, you know, my recent book title was The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. We're about 5 years into this deleveraging process, and what that means is working off the huge debts that were run up by U.S. consumers and, of course, by the financial sector, banks, primarily on a global basis. But we're about halfway through that, and at the rate we're going, it'll take another 5 to 7 years for that to be completed. During that period, we think will continue to have very slow economic growth. We'll have declining income, certainly after you adjust for inflation, and we're headed for deflation, not inflation. And yeah, that's true. I mean, about one-third of people, according to surveys, who lose their jobs and find another job, if they're lucky, they're working for less than they did on the previous job. And we're seeing this even in the state and local area. You know, government is far away from the marketplace. They're the last to know when these changes happen. But even state and local governments are starting to actually cut wages and hire people at lower levels than the previous ones, and because they're under fire because of budget constraints and, of course, way underfunded pension funds.
Well, does that reset the bar down to where the base level now gets set down at a lower rate, and we have to start growing off of a lower base?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And what it really means is that all of the spending that was supported by the decline in the saving rate, the increase in borrowing that took place in the 80s and 90s, that we're now retracing that, and we're kind of going back to where we started, if you will. And, of course, it's fun on the way up, it's painful on the way down, but it is a reset. And I think it is true that a lot of people are going to find that they're not going to command the kind of salaries that their parents did. Another thing, we did a report, we have a monthly newsletter, Insight. We did one in July talking about the problem of higher education. Right now you have a lot of people who go to college. They think that college makes them smart. It doesn't. Maybe you make more income if you're a college graduate, but that's because smart people go to college, not because going to college makes you smart. People, they have soft majors in less than stellar institutions. They come out with huge student loans and wonder why they can't get good jobs. And they probably never will.
And you're right. Dr. Schilling, if you can hang on a minute, I'd like to come back after the break, talk to you about the fiscal cliff and a little more about what you anticipate from the Eurozone. So if you'll stay with us just a moment. Folks, we've got the best show that we've had in a long, long time. We've got Dr. Gary Schilling with us. We'll be talking with him a little bit more on the other side of the break. You're listening to Straight Talk Money, where you get straight answers to your questions about your money. And we'll be back to you in just a few moments.
Stay with me, and don't you ever leave.
Welcome back, folks. By the way, by the end of our next little session with Dr. Schilling, you're going to understand why you need to subscribe to his newsletter. He has a monthly newsletter entitled Insight. It's $339 a year. It is an excellent, excellent publication. For those of you out there that are really serious about managing your money, and I know a lot of you are. I know a lot of you manage your money yourselves. I get this publication. Several other advisors that I know have got this publication. It is something that people within the industry read, because you get insights from Dr. Schilling that you don't get from any place else. Dr. Schilling, let's talk about Europe. You said that Europe is in a recession. How bad is it going to get? Are the Germans going to leave the euro? Is Greece going to leave the euro? What's going to happen to the euro?
Boy, that's who knows what's going to happen. But there's a lot of effort in the Eurozone to keep the thing together because of the chaos that would result if it fell apart, the runs on the banks. Everybody says, who's next if, say, Greece leaves? So there's a lot of pressure. And also the French and the Germans, you know, the Eurozone really is a culmination of their efforts after World War II to decide they ought to communicate in a way other than they had for centuries, which is all-out war. They figure if they can integrate their economies, they'd reduce the odds. And so there's a lot of political and psychological and cultural capital behind this, if you will. But, of course, the alternative to a breakup is simply the continual bailouts. And these bailouts are now more and more being done through the European Central Bank, which is really supporting the deficits of Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, et cetera, and so it's really there's no solution to the problem. But I think in the meanwhile, as far as results for investors, one is the euro, the currency, I think is going to continue to decline. We're looking for that to get back to parity 1-to-1. And right now it's 123. We also think that there is a risk, and this is just a risk, that a major European bank runs into trouble. And if that's the case, that could spread to the U.S. financial sector. The banks are so intertwined. They through loans, through derivatives, through leases, through lending back and forth. So I think that's the risk.
So actually, the Eurozone then could be the next shoe to fall for us because of the interrelationships between the U.S. banks. I know, for instance, there's a lot more concern now that the malaise of Europe has moved to Spain and possibly Italy. That seems to be bringing more concern on popular press. Is that?
That's true, because if you look at Portugal, Ireland, and Greece, the three of them together count for less than 6% of Eurozone gross domestic product, GDP. But Spain alone is 11%, and Italy is 17%. So you're talking about much bigger countries in terms of their impact if they do run into trouble. And of course, if you look at the yields on their bonds, people have been fleeing those. The yields have been going up, and they've been retreating to treasuries and to German government bonds.
You made a little statement there, is that there doesn't seem to be any cure. Yeah, kind of speaking for the general public, that's part of the frustration, I think, that the investors see out there. There doesn't seem to be a cure for anything here. I mean,
well,
we're kicking the can down the road. They're kicking the can down the road. Where does the can end up going?
Except time. And you know, people have been hoping that somehow there is a magic bullet, that the Fed, the Federal Reserve, that the other central banks are going to pull this out of their quiver and it's going to solve all the problems. Well, they have dumped unbelievable amounts of credit into the system, and it really hasn't. And the same is true of fiscal policy. All the tax cuts, tax rebates, spending through state and local governments directly, all that's done is run up the deficits to close to $1.5 trillion. But what it tells you, I think, is that this immense fiscal and monetary stimulus is being offset by the massive deleveraging in the private sector. In other words, the deleveraging in the private sector is so great that despite these huge deficits and efforts by the Federal Reserve, the economy is still very weak. And so it really says there isn't much they can't. They pretty well shot their wads on that anyway. And I think all that's left is for time, and this is what I've been predicting all along, time, another 5 to 7 years for this whole deleveraging process to work its way through, for debts to be worked down to more normal levels. And then the economy will be in good shape. Europe is another question. Who knows? But the U.S. economy, I think, will eventually right itself. But we got to get through the deleveraging, and there isn't much that can be done to speed up the process.
Yeah, it's just going to happen. Speaking of time, the one issue out there in which there seems to be a time bomb is this fiscal cliff. What are your thoughts about the fiscal cliff? I personally don't think we're going to go over it. I can't imagine them letting this happen, but politics being what it is, who knows? What are your thoughts about the fiscal cliff?
Yeah, well, bear in mind that we've got the election coming up, and everybody who's an incumbent wants to get reelected, even the Tea Party crowd. And I don't think that even those folks are going to go to their constituents and say, hey, austerity's good for the soul, suck it up, buddy. You know, that doesn't garner many votes. So I rather suspect that they will approach the fiscal cliff problem before the election, and not like this year, wait until actually February and then make a retroactive first year. And what we're talking about here, of course, is the automatic reductions in stimulus, in other words, negative stimulus, drag on the economy that will occur at the end of the year if they do nothing. The unemployment benefits will go back from a maximum of 99 weeks to 26 weeks. Payroll tax on individual will go from 4.2% to 6.2%. The Bush-era tax cuts will disappear, and it will start in this $1.2 trillion cut in government spending over it's spread over 10 years, but it'll kick in at the beginning of next year. This is the fiscal cliff, and it would cumulative over the next 2 years, if they did nothing, take 3.5 or 4% of real GDP, of economic activity away, and that in itself is a major recession. So, again, I just don't think in a weakening economy and probably rising unemployment continuing right into the election that that's going to happen.
All right, so you think they'll do something?
Yeah, but bear in mind that what they're doing is not adding new stimulus. They're simply preventing a negative stimulus. They're preventing the removal of earlier stimulus that would happen with these automatic moves if they do nothing. It's not a net new stimulus to the economy.
Yeah, they're just preventing more piling on, I guess. Now, what about taxes, though? There seems to be a rising chorus of changing the tax rates, particularly on the top 1%, and more specifically for investors on the long-term capital gains tax. Do you see anything happening there?
I think that they'll probably come down to just extending the current law, and then we'll see what happens in the election. If the Republicans end up controlling Congress, then they probably will make those tax cuts permanent, the Bush era tax cuts, and there might be further cuts. I mean, that's certainly what Romney is advocating. Obviously, if the Democrats have a sweep in Washington, it'll be quite the other way. But this has become, I think, more a political issue than an economic issue in terms of taxes. Obviously, nobody likes to pay higher taxes. The effects on the economy, you know, there's studies both sides on that as to whether higher taxes on higher income people are going to retard or help the economy. I think it's more a political than a economic issue, and it's a tremendous gridlock and jockeying for position in a pre-election, very charged environment. That's really what's governing the whole debate.
Okay, you have a great section. I really love your publication Insight, by the way. And as I was saying earlier, folks, and I think I got cut off there for a second for some reason. I really encourage you to go out and invest in this publication.
If anybody's interested, we've got a toll-free number they can call. It's 888-346-7444. 888-346-7444.
Okay, I'm gonna give that out several times if you don't mind later.
Sure.
On because
appreciate it.
Because they really should do that. You've got a great. I love the way you divide up your publication, and you've got one that just says investment themes, and you really break it down where you think you should be and not. And I was kind of interested to see in the most recent one that you were saying sell your house, your second home, your investment houses, but on the other same side, you liked rental apartments and medical office buildings. So you like certain parts of real estate, but other parts of real estate you do not.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the residential area, you know, we're in a situation where house prices have been declining. They're down a third from their peak at the beginning of 2006. And a lot of people look at that and say, why should I own an asset declining in price? And, of course, a lot of people can't qualify for mortgage with tighter lending standards. If they own a house already, it's underwater. The mortgage is greater than the value of the house. They worry about their jobs. I mean, there's a lot of reasons that people are becoming renters as opposed to homeowners. And home ownership made a wonderful sense 10 years ago when house prices were climbing and it was a wonderful investment, but it's the reverse today. So rental apartments, I think, are going to continue to be attractive. Medical office buildings, that's really the aging of the population, quite apart from the Obamacare medical bill. And interestingly, physicians now, 55% of them work for hospitals. They're moving out of storefronts, and they're moving into hospital campuses or satellites, and that involves a lot of new construction. So with the expansion of medical care one way or the other, that's an area I think will continue to be very attractive.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Just two more questions. There are a lot of people talking about the fact that the market's really gotten ahead of itself. What do you see for the market going forward here? Do you think we've kind of peaked here and we're looking for more of a sell-off? Is there more risk in the market than opportunity?
I think there's tremendous risk, and it's particularly because of disappointment in profits. I think over the next year or so, we're going to see a very sharp decline in corporate profits. We're looking for $80 a share on the S&P 500 over a 12-month period, and that may be the second half of this year, first half of next year, but that compares with about $100 a share or more that Wall Street analysts are looking for. And the reason for that is threefold. One is that I think with a recession, we're going to see less revenue for corporations. Top line growth is going to be negative. Secondly, their ability to cut costs and improve their margins, and that's been the route to profits lately, is not coming through anymore. They don't have the big productivity growth, the declining unit labor costs they did earlier. Maybe they've just picked all the low-hanging fruit in terms of cost control. They got to wait for more to ripen. But for whatever reasons, that's not working anymore. And the third thing is a strong dollar. And that means that multinationals have what they call translation losses. In other words, their earnings abroad are simply worth less when they translate them back into dollars. So if that's the case, if you got $80 a share and you put a bear market bottom PE of those price earnings ratios of 10, you got 800. You got 800 on the S&P, and that's a far cry from where you are now, which is 1395. So I think there's considerable downside risk in stocks.
All right. Well, there's one question I like to ask all of my guests, and I really want to ask this one of you. Is there anything that really keeps you up at night? You understand finances. You understand what's going on out there, the political landscape. Is there anything that you, when you think of your children, your grandchildren, really you worry about?
Not really. No, I don't think so. I think the U.S. economy is inherently, it's broad, it's deep, it's resilient. And very important in today's world, we're the best game in town. I mean, you know, we're not in great shape, but we're collecting a number of descriptions of it. We're the tallest midget, the slowest falling rock, the best horse in the glue factory, or one of our clients just came up with, we're the Val Victorian in summer remedial school. there's more than just humor in that. I mean the U.S. is the place that people want to be. I mean, it's certainly a lot better. The dollar is the global currency. We're a lot better than whatever's in second place.
Dr. Schilling, thank you so much for being with us. Your insight is invaluable. I encourage you all to go get a copy of Dr. Schilling's Insight. The phone number is 888-346-7444. Dr. Gary Schilling, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts today with us on Straight Talk Money. Thank you, sir.
You're most welcome. Glad to be of help.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Back to you in just a moment, folks.